Presenting a proven way to build your endowment with a sustainable gift planning program, this is the Gift Planning Development Podcast, an ongoing forum designed to help you meet all of your gift planning goals.
Welcome to the Gift Planning Development Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Tumalo, CEO of Gift Planning Development. And my guest today is Ben Lee. Ben is the regional director of Make-A-Wish in Susquehanna Valley, Pennsylvania, an organization that I, my wife, Lorraine, and I are very passionate about and active donors and excited to have Ben here. Quick history about Ben. First of all, Ben, welcome.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here. I met Ben recently, and what really struck me about you is your clearly skill set. Maybe you had to work hard at it, and you'll let us know. But your ability to, as you say, have a non-anxious presence, which I love. And it feels like a lot of that came out of your experience as an ordained minister. You had told me that you pastored in four states, from Alaska to Kansas to Ohio and Pennsylvania.
That's right. Yeah, I've lived in a lot of time zones.
Yeah, and I've always believed and have read and taught to my clients that when we look at pastors and psychologists, people that have these skill sets of being able to be present with people and listen, that we can learn a lot from them in our work as fundraising, especially planned giving. Mm-hmm. Where I believe we need to develop a sensitivity. It's not transactional. It's on the donor's timeline. And we have to slow down, right? We're so busy. Mm. We're so under pressure in every aspect of our life. I know I am. I'm constantly in a hurry. And it's just like you have to calm down and be present with people. Mm-hmm. I just saw the movie, Won't You Be My Neighbor? Fred Rogers.
Oh, that is on my must-see list. I'm looking forward to it. What did you observe or take away from that?
A lot. The big one, and it relates to this, is Fred's ability to be present with people. Mm-hmm. And he had a slow pace. And he wasn't afraid of the pause. That pause, that silence. Either silence after somebody asked him a question before he responded, or silence after somebody responded to his question. He was okay having that little space in there. And I think it changes the whole dynamic. We have, and I'm gonna let you talk in a minute, so thanks for your patience. Talk about silence, right? I'll give you some silence in a second. But I just want to kind of get it all out in the open here. We all talked to some people, and maybe it's up here in the Northeast, because you've been all over the country. There's a lot of people who will just almost step over you, or just, it feels like they can't wait till I stop talking so they can start talking.
Yes.
Yeah. So let me start with that question. Do you notice that generally, having lived in all these, pretty much all parts of the country, do you notice a different pace of people speaking or listening?
That might be true interpersonally, friends getting together, or the way that people talk over a transaction, say at a restaurant or a cash register. I think professional situations like a fundraiser meeting a donor, I think that's pretty similar no matter where you live in the country, because there's something about the tension that as the professional we can bring into that relationship, that silence is uncomfortable. They typically say that we should do 80% of the listening and 20% of the talking in those situations. But my experience for me on my worst days, and I think a lot of fundraising professionals, is that we're doing about 80% of the talking and about 20% of the listening. And that's not to our benefit or the benefit of the relationship.
And why do you think that is? Why do you think people...
Well, I think probably because we're fundamentally not at peace in the moment. I think we bring a lot of our dis-ease with us into a conversation around giving. Putting aside the planned giving just for a minute, just thinking about even the nature of an ask. I think the fundraiser is wise to do a pretty searching moral self-inventory about the way that they grew up thinking about money. We bring a lot of baggage to the table around the issue of money. Whether we grew up in poverty, in middle class, or with excess, our own understanding of money is going to color how we think about asking somebody else for money. And so we can bring a lot of nervous energy into that conversation. And I think one of the ways nervous energy expresses itself is through chatter. Chatter, chatter, chatter. Because I think deep down inside, it's a way that we can stay in control. And when we're quiet, that leaves space for somebody else to be in control or possibly ask us a question we don't have the answer to, or maybe take the conversation in a direction that's important to the donor, but maybe not important to us.
It's a thank you. It's a huge, huge point. And I've been integrating it more into my teachings and trainings and speaking about, yes, we need a process, but the donor has a process too, and let them be in control. However you want to say it, let them be in control, let them feel like they're in control. I don't want to make it sound like I'm being manipulative. Mm-hmm.
But give them space and freedom to be able to share and talk about what's important to them. And if there's a way they want to steer the conversation, it is not to our benefit to steer them away from that.
Well, exactly. Well said. And again, I think, like you said, we're afraid of being out of control and then, oh my God, we're not going to get the gift or we're not going to get to the next level. Mm-hmm. I had a client call me recently and she said, well, I have this donor and we called, one of our student callers called her and she was all upset because she makes big gifts and why is the student caller calling? And she was really upset. She seems to be okay now, but we need to talk to her about a gift for the campaign and I don't know whether to talk to her or not. And she said, what do you think I should do? I said, just call her and let her be in control and ask her. Mm-hmm. And say, I know we upset you. It sounds, please tell me, are we in a good place? However you want to say it, but is this a good time for us to be chatting about your campaign gift
right.
or not? And I feel kind of awkward uh-huh. asking you because of everything that happened, mm-hmm. but I don't want to make the decision for you. You're the donor. Mm-hmm. Should we be, is that a conversation we should be having, right? So yeah. let the donor, what's wrong with that? Let them be in control. Yeah. They want to be in control of the process anyway.
Absolutely.
Right.
So to segue this conversation away from the ask in a conversation to the subject of planned giving mm-hmm. and making a planned gift, I think just as a fundraiser would benefit from doing a moral inventory on all the baggage they may bring to the table around money, I think that same conversation needs to take place internally around the issue of death and dying and end of life issues. Because if we are fundamentally scared or we bring a lot of uncertainty or nervous energy, to use that phrase again, into the room or to the table with us, that's going to come across to the donor and they can feel that and then they're uncomfortable. But if we can do the opposite and we can bring that phrase you used at the outset, a non-anxious presence to the conversation, we can see the stress like a balloon just slowly deflate from somebody sitting across from us. And when we can talk about matters simply, matter-of-factly, respectfully, and when appropriate, even a small amount of levity sprinkled in here and there, it's amazing what that can do to help move a conversation forward. And I think there may be something about being a minister, as you said in your observation, maybe there is something about pastors who have been invited into a lot of really intimate personal moments in a person's life where they develop that ability, maybe more than the average person, to have those conversations about, frankly, what is an eventual reality for all of us, and that is that we are going to die.
And in your training, and I know you taught at seminary as well, do they spend a lot of time focusing on developing this skill set?
Yeah. I've had classes titled Pastoral Care and Counseling. And it is precisely the ability to be a listener, to be in a room with somebody through the stages of life, birth, transition periods that are significant, weddings, baptisms, difficult moves, illness, and then eventually death. But what's unique about fundraisers is that as we build relationships with people, I found that as a fundraiser, it's remarkable how often we get invited sometimes into people's most significant moments. Working with Make-A-Wish, as I do, was a really interesting transition away from pastoral ministry to sitting across from families on a regular basis who are facing the reality of death many times for a child. And I am so grateful that many of those skill sets transferred over. When I was in the Army, we used to say there's no such thing as an atheist in a foxhole. And now I say with Make-A-Wish, there's no such thing as an atheist in a children's hospital. That in those moments, people are desperate and they're looking for help, for hope, for somebody to give some kind of direction. And it's amazing the gift that we can give somebody just by being present to them and listening.
And a quick plug for Make-A-Wish. It's not a death wish, right? What percentage of the children who have a wish completed survive? Is there a stat?
Yeah, or grow into adulthood, as we say. Yeah, I would say for us, it's the majority. It's right. anywhere between 60 and 80%, depending on the sample of kids who receive a wish in childhood, grow up to live healthy, productive lives. And we like to believe, in fact, the data does show that a wish contributes to that positive turnaround. Mm. So there's a popular stigma about Make-A-Wish being a dying wish granting organization. Yeah. But the point remains that every child that comes to us is dealing with a life-threatening critical illness. Mm. So there's an extraordinary vulnerability there, and people are shaken to the core.
Incredible. You mentioned that course. Just a thought occurred to me, wondering if we lay people, could take a course like that somewhere.
Pastoral care and counseling.
I wonder if we could do that just as part of our...
That's interesting. Idea, you, right? You would want to approach your church and see what processes existed in front of you, and I'm sure the answer is different for anyone who's listening.
Yeah.
But at a minimum, if you belong to a faith community, and maybe you've got access to a priest, pastor, rabbi, imam, whatever, it's almost guaranteed they've had some training in those areas. And I think it would be fascinating for a fundraiser or a planned gift officer to sit across from a clergy member and say, I have conversations with people around death and dying a lot. I'd like to get better at it for their sake and for mine. What would you recommend? Mm. And honestly, I think the pastor in that instance would feel honored and affirmed to be able to contribute to your success. I don't know who wouldn't feel honored just to be asked the question. That's a great idea.
Yeah. Interesting. We have at our church, we have a woman pastor and who's middle-aged-ish. I hope she doesn't mind me saying that if she's listening. She is. I'm middle-aged. We're middle-aged. And a younger gentleman, mm-hmm. Male pastor, young guy. And last time I had a death in the family, I always, anytime we have something like that, even a dog dying,
yeah.
I always go over there. Pastor Diane, she's an animal nut, so I always mm-hmm. go to her if the dog dies and go to. But she has this incredible gift of just saying the right things in the moment. And Pastor Keith is quiet. And candidly, when I had called after my sister passed, and I was hoping I would get Diane, because I'm like, oh, Diane, I'm just going to meet with her, and she's going to have all the great things to say. Mm-hmm. She always has the right thing to say. And Keith is great, but he's quiet, and I thought I needed somebody to tell me all the right things I wanted to hear. Mm-hmm. Called the church office. They said, Pastor Diane's on vacation, but Pastor Keith is here. And there was a part of me inside, I was like, oh, all right. So I went over. But it, right on point with what we're talking about, while he doesn't have all the answers mm-hmm. and is not as vocal or have all these incredible way of spewing out all these inspiring things, he has this incredible gift of exactly what we're talking about, this non-anxious presence. And it was that presence and not afraid of the silence, everything we're talking about, that actually helped me so greatly to kind of, he was like the vehicle, the catalyst to help me figure it out for myself. Like, he wasn't going to tell me, not that anybody can in this situation when you lose a loved one, right? There's nothing, mm-hmm. I learned, there's nothing anybody can say to make it all feel better.
Yeah.
Just can't, right? Mm-hmm. And people say, I'm getting a little off topic, but people will say stupid things when you lose a loved one, right? Or when somebody has cancer. Mm-hmm. And they're good people.
Yes, they will.
Right? But nobody teaches us what to say. And mm-hmm. I learned that you don't really have to say anything. Just be there and be present, right? And that's what Pastor Keith has is, I mean, he certainly said some good things, but most of it was just him being present and letting me kind of figure it out for myself, because he was not afraid to have that space, that quiet. And I think it's exactly what we're talking about with planned giving, especially. I always like to say, it's not about having all the answers. It's about maybe having all the questions. And just, as you say, leave that space open for donors to figure it out for themselves, because maybe they're thinking about something, because people are not thinking about their estate planning generally. Mm-hmm. And we know that. We know that from all the research. And maybe this is a way for us, as just like a pastor or a therapist, to help the donor think about this stuff for the first time. So maybe we're the catalyst sometimes in some situations. Mm-hmm. For them to kind of figure it out. I'm here, I can offer ideas, but I'm going to be here and listen. And if I built your trust, I'm going to ask you certain questions, right? Provided we have that trusting mm-hmm. relationship. But maybe part of my role as a gift officer is to create that opportunity for you to kind of think about, figure this stuff out on your own. I'm not talking about the how do I plan my estate and avoid taxes and that stuff, but from a emotional, spiritual standpoint, whatever is involved in making this gift decision.
And you and I are people that sound like we're pretty plugged into a community of faith where we have an outlet. There's a person, a people, a community to help us process those kinds of questions. But as we know, there's a lot of people, a lot of donors that don't have a community of faith around them, or maybe a psychiatrist or maybe some good friends to help them ask those big questions about death and dying. And man, what a gift to think that, you know, we're wearing a plan giving or a fundraising officer hat in that moment, but we can be a means of grace to people too. And maybe there's a little bit of pastor inside all of us sometimes, and we need to be. You know, one story I'll tell you real quick that highlights, I know, something important to you, and that is the power of presence and how our work is not done behind the computer or on the phone, but it's done with people. Back when I was a youth pastor living in Kansas City one night, I was out celebrating a birthday, and I got a phone call from one of the teens in the youth group, and she was hysterical and told me that her 26-year-old sister, Alicia, had died unexpectedly. Oh. It was one of those left field, no warning, just died. And I was a couple of hours away, and it was late at night when she called me, and I made the decision in that moment to go be with the family that night. So I drove about 3 hours and got to the family farm out in the middle of nowhere at about 1 a.m. And there were cars that had been pulled in and people had gathered like you do in those kind of moments. And I walked into a room of about probably 30 people who were just broken. I mean, you can imagine there is no prep, no words to prepare you for that kind of loss in that moment. And I went over to Alicia's husband, who had just lost his wife, and Emmy's mom was standing there, and I gave a couple of hellos, and the husband wrapped his arms around me and through his sobbing tears said, "Ben, why did God allow Alicia to die?" And the room went silent, and all eyes and ears were on the pastor.
Whoa.
And I remember thinking, okay, at this point I've got about 8 years of post-secondary education, a lot of theology, a lot of seminary. I've been expertly trained for moments just like this. And in that moment, my mind went blank. I had nothing to say. As you said, sometimes there are no answers, and the attempt to give an answer cheapens the reality and the heaviness of the moment. And I just looked at him and said, "I don't know." And Emmy's mother collapsed into my arms sobbing, and I was convinced she was crying at how terrible my answer was. Well, hung out for a few hours, and that next weekend I was making my way through the family line at the funeral. And to a person, people could not stop saying how grateful they were that I showed up that night.
Wow.
And how much my presence meant to that family in that moment. And I was driving home from that experience doing the pastoral version of cursing myself at how much I dropped the ball when it mattered the most. But what I learned in that moment, going through that line of people just expressing their love for me and their gratitude, was how you cannot shortcut the power of presence. And, you know, I don't know if we're on topic or off topic here, or even what the topic is anymore, but, I think you were getting at earlier, just, you know, we wear a lot of hats, we perform a lot of tasks, but there's something almost sacred about a planned gift officer having that end of life conversation. And I think people can walk away from that conversation when we bring a non-anxious presence, we bring a grace, a mercy, a gentleness, and maybe even permission to laugh sometimes, because that's appropriate too. That a person can walk away affirmed and feeling better and more secure about what's coming in their own life, in addition to the gift they may or may not give us. And when I think about purpose and meaning in my work, that's a good day's work.
Well said. And a couple of things as we wrap up, I want to be clear that we're not saying that plan giving is just about dying, right? Plan giving is about planning, hence the name, right? Gift planning. You're planning just like you would any other aspect of your life, right? Hopefully. It's not just about as a board member said to me recently at a presentation, you're just waiting for me to die, right? So just to be clear, it's not just about that, right? And we work hard, hopefully, to help donors understand the benefit of planned gift commitment. Mm-hmm. Lorraine and I have planned gift commitment with Make-A-Wish.
Yes, you do.
We're benefiting from it now, right? Not mm-hmm. when we pass. You'll benefit from it, or the kids will benefit from it when we pass, but Lorraine and I are benefited from it now while we're alive.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I just want to make that really clear. We're not saying it's all about that death moment, right?
Right.
But it is about people facing the mortality.
Yeah.
And if you look at the work of Russell James and some of the other researchers, most people don't like to face their mortality. So just to be clear, we're not saying it's all about death,
mm-hmm.
right?
And I love the conversation I had with you and your wife last week and how much Lorraine had mentioned that she loved the knowledge that her life's work was going to outlive her and was going to continue doing good, in our instance, granting the wishes of critically ill children, and what a gift in her life that was to her and how much joy that brought her. And you're right, it is a wonderful gift we can give our donors in life, not just in death.
Beautiful. Man, it's like this was rehearsed. This is off the cuff, but it sounds like you rehearsed it. Thank you. So any takeaways, if there were maybe, I don't want to say three, because anytime I say, like if I start a sentence, well, here are three things, I always forget the third one. But are there any takeaways for our listeners that how do we develop this skill set?
Mm-hmm.
We talked about my idea.
Your idea, yeah.
I have to figure it out if it's out there. But
I think that's a great one.
Read, I'm sure the books, read or online courses, maybe there's an online course on pastoral care to get developed that more of that I call it sensitivity, right?
And pick up the phone and call your pastor, priest, rabbi, whatever. Like I said, I think they would be honored to think, wow, I have something to contribute. Mm. Cool.
Yeah.
Because they probably don't have a lot of money to write a check, but they can contribute to the good work the organization's doing this way.
Beautiful. Anything else?
Well, what can somebody do? I would say that idea of just taking some time to really think, what is the baggage that I bring to the conversation around death?
Mm.
Is it something that I have a lot of personal anxiety around? Or is it something I am at peace with? And if it's something I haven't made peace with personally, then I probably am going to transfer that discomfort, dis-ease to the people I'm talking about death and dying with. So I would start by doing a careful inventory around my own understanding of death and thinking about those matters and the ways in which the deaths in my life I've had to deal with, how have I processed through those? And that would be a starting point for developing the ability to be a non-anxious presence talking to people about their eventual death.
Beautiful. And if people want to learn more about Make-A-Wish, what's the URL for Make-A-Wish?
Well, nationally, Make-A-Wish is at wish.org, and we grant wishes for children in every county in the United States of America.
Hmm, beautiful. Ben, thank you so much. Appreciate you being here.
My pleasure, Joe.
As you salute. Thank you for your service to our country.
I guess your podcast listeners couldn't hear my salute.
But yes, thank you for your service as well.
Thank you for listening to the Gift Planning Development Podcast. For more information on any of the topics you've heard about today, please go to giftplanningdevelopment.com.